Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is architectural historian Christine Madrid French. She's a preservationist who's worked to save modernist architecture around the country and especially within the National Park Service. She worked for the National Park Service as a historian, and in 2000, she co-founded the Recent Past Preservation Network and served as president for 9 years. She then worked as the director of the Modernism Plus Recent Past program for the National Trust for Historic Preservation, two-year project funded through 2011, and as an expert member on the 20th Century Heritage Committee for the International Council of Monuments and Sites. She's currently serving as project director for Preservation Capen, a landmark effort to save an 1885 house by cutting it in two, floating it across a lake to the grounds of the Alban Polasek Museum and Sculpture Gardens in Winter Garden, Florida. She'll be the guest for Philbrook's Third Thursday event tonight. The event gets underway at 5:30 with a lecture at 6:30. It's also co-sponsored by Modern Tulsa and the Tulsa Foundation for Architecture as she talks about saving the modern century. Christine Madrid French is my guest today. Christine Madrid French, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. This is fun.
You once said you have a heart for architectural underdogs. So what are architectural underdogs today in America?
Well, I appreciate your research because I must have said that a while ago. There are many architectural underdogs in America right now. The reason I like them and I'm drawn to the causes, I think, is because I feel that people don't know the whole story of these structures that are going to be demolished. Usually the underdog is almost always the one that's going to be demolished. And I just want to tell the stories of these structures to everyone.
And what are the underdogs in America today?
What are they right now?
I think in the article that you were quoted saying this, it was about a brutalist building, which was a massive concrete building, I think, somewhere in Florida, I believe.
Right. Brutalist buildings are underdogs. Any small structure that doesn't have a good floor plate ratio at this point could be an underdog.
A floor plate ratio.
This is what I hear. If you can't utilize the certain square footage, if there's no return for the building, those can be underdogs. The underdogs that I look at specifically are usually architect-designed structures that haven't been formally recognized as historic yet.
Mm. And when you talk about that idea that the return on the actual square footage is not good, is that a function of a particular style?
No, it can be any style. So It might be a 1920s a cafe. Could be a like I was eating dinner at a bank the other day, the Vault in Tulsa, which is beautiful. And it was built in the mid-1950s. But the amount of square footage you have there is huge. So if I was a developer, I would look at that spot and say, well, I could build a tower. I can build housing over a restaurant. So what happens is doesn't look profitable on the surface to save these unusual buildings, these underdogs. So we have to go the next step with them.
Well, and yet you had dinner at this location, and that's a relatively new space. It's been closed for years. So, I mean, that's obviously a success story.
It's a success story right now. So how do we make sure that it stays successful? We're always talking about saving structures for the next generation. In some sense, I am the next generation, and buildings were saved that now I can enjoy. So how do we make sure that the Vault, the old bank, goes forward another 50 years without somebody, looking at that property? It's a big lot. This is really a disadvantage for structures all over the country.
So it's less the actual building style. And I think a lot of people say, well, modernist architecture, that's still not yet appreciated for people, especially for people who appreciate it. But it sounds like it's more of a dollar and cents decision rather than a particular style that's out of fashion or deemed ugly. It's more, can I make money on this every square inch of this property?
Right. That's the prevailing argument right now. Uh-huh. So it does switch. So, for a while it was, well, none of these buildings are suitably ADA adaptable. That was the big argument. And then there was, well, no, we just don't like modernism. And then now it's like, well, they're not really profitable. So as a preservationist or an advocate for structures, you have to be very dynamic in your approach. And you have to have arguments. You have to have five different arguments to help save these structures because it could be any one of those things.
Now, let's talk about ADA compliant. That was a big issue and still is in a lot of renovations for earlier structures. Have the techniques for dealing with the ADA changed to where it's more cost effective than it used to be?
I think American with Disabilities Act is something that we need to accommodate in all of these buildings. And actually what we've done in some of the structures I've worked on is exceed the ADA recommendations by incorporating things for if your vision disabled, you can actually, you do different things with the stairs. This is not mandated by ADA. So when we're working on historic structures, we actually exceed it to show that it can be done.
Well, what would you say the most underappreciated style of architecture in America is today?
A brutalism, for sure. So I can explain brutalism.
Please.
Concrete. So it's based on béton brut, which is the French term for unfinished concrete. And we've adapted that term and just called it brutalism, which, automatically right away. Why would you want to save a building that's brutalist? It doesn't make any sense. So in some sense, the term is killing the structure. But there is a movement, especially in places that have a lot of these. In Boston, for instance, a group of architects is very active in saving brutalist structures. But they said, we don't like the term. So this is the next generation saving the buildings. And they said, we're going to rename it heroic concrete.
And for those who don't know what a brutalist building really looks like, it's a lot of poured concrete, usually little or small windows, and sometimes not windows at all. Sometimes it's like a strong concrete form.
Yeah. And I say they're not huggable. So if you go up to a brutalist building, you will scratch your elbows on the concrete. They're very rough form. But I didn't understand them either. I grew up with a couple. I was like, I don't like those. But I'm trying to get beyond my own biases to see what other people see in architecture. So I had a lot of these architects in Boston. I said, take me to your brutalist buildings and show me exactly what these buildings are saying to you. Why do you value this structure? And it was really enlightening. It was really an epiphany. They would go very close to the formwork and show me where the wood pieces were still embedded in the concrete. The concrete reflects the formwork, which are the wood pieces used to hold the concrete when you pour it.
Right.
When you take the formwork off, the concrete resembles pieces of wood.
Yeah, it has that texture. Yeah, right.
So they saw it as a naturalist kind of structure.
Interesting. Now it seems like the tide has turned on a lot of modernist structures. Maybe brutalism comes a little later, but I'm saying that mid-century, after Art Deco sort of era. And I think it has a lot to do, the preservations, that's been a big area of fights in the last 20 years or so. But Mad Men has had an awful big effect on modernism. What would you say that television series? I mean, it's made us look at objects and all these things which we probably thought of for baby boomers as things from our childhood. But it gives a new sort of appreciation for that look.
I think so. And I just found a quote from Matthew Weiner. It's about his work on Mad Men and how one of the things he was the writer.
Yeah.
And one of the initial impulses for him was to show that you should save these buildings because we're going to miss them someday. So he placed them in this context of the past that we value and we appreciate and we enjoy watching. So a lot of people say everyone hates modernism. They really don't. I think they just don't understand necessarily the structures the way they are positioned today. They don't see the historic context. But Mad Men did that for people.
Probably a uniformly reviled form is the motor court. The 40s and 50s motor court. But when you see a brilliantly restored motor court, it is so, so cool. Let me ask you, is it just a matter of time before an architectural style, I'm thinking of like Victorian houses. At one point, you couldn't tear Victorian houses out quick enough. Art Deco, the same thing. We now appreciate those. And in fact, it's actually an object of celebration in a lot of communities. Is modernism going to be the same thing?
It already is, definitely.
So in some places.
In some places, like Los Angeles. Here in Tulsa, there's a very strong movement to save the modernism of Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
In Florida, it's a little bit weaker. I think in New York, there's quite a development. But even in the small towns, I think if you're in smaller areas, you have less examples of modernism. So it might just be the school and the gas station and the library. And so those are even more important to save.
So do you think it's just a matter of time before the public see the beauty of an older architectural style or the you know, the value of an older architectural style or what?
No, I don't know what it is, but it's, it keeps going in circles. So the thing I'm finding out now is across my desk recently, I've had quite a few Victorians all of a sudden, 1885, going to be demolished. So, and we thought, oh, didn't we do that? But we did it, you know, like 30 or 40 years ago. These buildings need to be saved again. So this is one of the issues. So even if you save your Art Deco, your valued Art Deco theater, the next generation comes 40 years from now, the theater may be in danger again. So how do we make sure that we don't have to keep doing this over and over?
So what is the answer to make sure we keep from doing it over and over?
Really, you need preservation guidelines that protect the structure. So you're passing the baton of ownership. It's a stewardship issue, a stewardship and a future vision that lasts 200 years and not just let's do this for 40 years. So and then people then they'll say, well, we don't have anything that's old here. You know, if you go to Europe, things are from the 12th century. I said, but even in the 12th century, it was 40 years old at one time. So if they didn't keep it, we wouldn't have these things. So if you can imagine maybe the vault, the bank, can you imagine that building as 200 years old? Most people don't think of it that way. But I think to really have continuity in the landscape, we need to do that.
How in danger in a lot of communities are we of losing, say, that 40-year generation of style of buildings?
People don't want to see it because it's painful. But if you actually mapped it out, I remember I moved to Charlottesville, Virginia in 90 or something. And then in the next 10 years, almost every roadside motel was demolished in the next 10 years. It was just the moment. And that was it. So I moved in, and then they were there. And by the time I moved, they were all gone. And the landscape had changed entirely. So you mentioned motor courts.
Yeah. And we're here on Route 66. We had a ton of motor courts going right through Tulsa. There might be one left.
Right. So something that appears ubiquitous, it's like the passenger pigeon, you know, which was a bird that flew everywhere and then was endangered and then completely erased. It's extinct now. So the motel, right, the drive-in are like the passenger pigeons, basically, of architecture. There used to be 4,500 drive-ins across the country at the peak. I think it was 1972 or so. And now there's less than 500. And there, if you even go further, it's probably only like 300 that actually show movies because most are flea markets now and don't even show movies. So that's a structural type, very prevalent 20th century, almost completely gone. And same with motels. When I drove across the country in 1985, there were, you know, I could actually stay at these roadside motels. They were, you know, 25 years old. And if I did that same drive today, most of those would probably be gone.
Yeah. My guest today is Christine Madrid French, an architectural historian. She'll be appearing for Philbrook's Third Thursday event, co-sponsored by Modern Tulsa and the Tulsa Foundation for Architecture. The event gets underway at 5:30 with a lecture at 6:30, and she'll talk about some of her efforts. And she's been involved in a lot of things, from the National Trust to her most recent project, which will come to a completion in a couple of weeks, I think. Let's talk about Project Capen.
Capen. So I learned a lot with the Capen House. This is an 1885 house. It was for sale in Winter Park, Florida, which is...
So tell us a little about the house itself.
A big Victorian that had been altered numerous times in the 1920s. It was added. It was 4,200 square feet. It was for sale for $2 million. It was protected. It was on the actual register in the city. It went to foreclosure. The bank said, we'd like to withdraw the protection so we can sell the property. The city said, sure. And then the minute they took the protection off, then somebody bought the property and said, we want to tear down the house. The problem is it belonged to one of the founders of the town. There are very few 1885 structures left in Florida.
And this was right on the banks of a lake.
Right on the lake.
And so this was a structure everybody could see.
Right. And so this is a $2 million teardown. So it doesn't matter. You know, someone says, well, it's for sale for $4 million. No one will tear that down. I said, that doesn't really matter because it can be any price. So $2 million cash, we're going to tear it down. So the owners did say, well, we'll pause for maybe 4 months and you can try to move this house. If you want it, you can have it. but then they said, but you have to show us that you've raised all the money if we're going to pause in our plan. So three organizations got together, three nonprofits, which I really think shows the power of forming. When you can't do it by yourself, you get a whole group, you know, a collection of groups to do it. Three nonprofits, we got together. They hired me to work as project director because it very quickly turned into a huge issue
right
in the city. But we had to raise $450,000 in 4 months to save this house or it would be demolished. And that was a tight deadline. And we did it.
And then actually once you bought the house and raised the money for the house, you had to get it off the property. And that was something of an incredible feat in and of itself, because you didn't move it off the property via land. You moved it by water.
Yes. Our contractor, Frank Rourke, actually thought of that. He says, you know, we couldn't move it down the road like most buildings that are moved, because the tree canopy was too thick. And, you know, you raise a Victorian on it, just is enormous. So we couldn't do that. So he said, well, let's chop it in half and we'll float it across the lake. And the Alvin Plaszczak Museum, where I work now, had a lot available that they wanted to expand on. So he said, well, we'll float it across and we'll put it at the Alvin Plaszczak Museum.
Mm-hmm. And how did that go?
Well, it went great. We had to raise a lot more money after that when we came up with that plan. But we actually floated it in December, right on time. So we found out it was endangered in July, and we had actually were floating it across the lake by that December.
It's 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's amazing. And you've been putting it back together, and I guess the renovation's almost complete now at this point.
Yes, we're going to open in about 2 weeks. And the Winter Park History Museum was part of this, and also the Friends of Casa Feliz. So all three of the organizations are going to be celebrating this. It's a huge preservation victory.
Now, you're going to be talking about things like these joint efforts to preserve important structures in a community. What are some of the best ways to – it sounds like building alliances is one, but what are some of the other ways to preserve modern architecture in a given community or any sort of important architecture?
Well, I think it's important to understand that not everybody sees what you see. So I look at an old building. I see the history of it. It's all illuminated for me. It's like I'm reading, you know, the illuminated manuscript of medieval times. I see all the people who walk through it. I see how beautiful the woodwork is. I can see that. Other people come in and they just say, yikes, this is just needs to be demolished. I can't believe anyone would want to save this. So we have to get past that. The way that we got past that was we actually we sort of brand the building. We humanize it. So we give the building a personality that people want to attach to. Mm-hmm. And that brings them in the conversation initially. So I'll tell you, with the Capon House, we're cutting it in half and we're floating it across the lake. And it had to be pushed up on shore and then actually spun around. The two halves had to be spun around the wrong direction and then put back together. So I said, well, we'll call them Fred and Ginger, right? Like dancers. Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Well, that just took off. It took off. Everyone said it's Fred and it's Ginger. We must save Fred and Ginger and bring them back together at the Plaszczak Museum.
Hmm. You know, one of the things I run into when I hear people talk about preservation in Tulsa is, for example, in the downtown area, there was at one point a huge number of what we'd call Main Street storefronts. Now, there are still a few outcrops of Main Street storefronts, but a lot of them have been demolished. And I think when developers are looking, it says, well, there's a Main Street storefront there. We don't need to save this one. And I think people don't understand the idea of creating a real neighborhood or community. And that's also an important part of preservation. Ranch House is another example here in our city. In the Midtown section, ranch houses are being torn down every week. But they'll say, well, there are ranch houses around here, but it changes the character of the neighborhood. How do you get across that argument?
That is tough with the ranch house right now. The ranch house appears to be ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Why should we save a ranch house? It's so normal. But I was talking to the head of a history organization in New England, and he said sometimes the things that are the most common are actually the most important when you're taking that 200-year view. Right. Mm-hmm. So he says lots of people save their wedding dresses, for instance. And so he has a huge collection of wedding dresses, too many wedding dresses. But finally, they acquired a ranch house, a 1950s ranch house in absolutely original condition with original appliances. And he said, this is actually more valuable than something that isn't, you know, like a wedding dress, because it's so rare. You said people don't save their work boots, for instance, that kind of thing. So the everyday life is not recorded in that same way. And then even when we were talking about the building that you're in here, some of these buildings are absolutely unique in the world. There is not one other building like that. This is a lot of the buildings that we're talking about, even from the 20s through the 70s, weren't designed on a computer. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but they weren't designed on a computer and just splashed all over the country. They were very much articulated for each site.
And I should mention, you're talking about our building here, Kendall Hall, on the University of Tulsa campus, which is a much maligned building.
1974.
Right, something around there.
With like a lacquered pebble floor and carpeted walls. Very unusual. There's a bank that I would like to save, but nobody will listen, in Florida. And it has crushed beer cans painted black as an artwork. As part of a sculpture down one side of the bank. I said, nobody in the world has this. So this is absolutely unique and very important. But I haven't managed to penetrate yet.
And sometimes unique is not enough.
Oh, no, it's not enough. No.
Yeah. My guest today is Christine Madrid French, an architectural historian who will be a guest for Philbrook's Third Thursday event, talking about her work in architectural preservation for Modern Tulsa, the Tulsa Foundation for Architecture, and Philbrook. The event gets underway at 5:30. Well, now I'm going to ask about a sad story, and this is a story you've been involved very much in, Mission 66 architecture in the national parks. And I know you led a major campaign to try to save Richard Neutra's cyclorama at Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a typical modern structure. It was a round building. Part of it was to house the cyclorama. If you've ever been to Gettysburg, it has this 360-degree view of the battle from, I think it was painted in the 1880s, I believe. And this was a major fight, and eventually the Park Service demolished it.
They did, and actually that was really my preservation training from A to Z, was the cyclorama. I actually worked for the Park Service when I heard that that building was going to be examined, you know, for future use, which was a bad term. And so I said, well, all I have to do is go up there and I'll go to the public meeting, the usual three-minute presentation. All I have to do is tell them how important it is, and they'll understand and they'll change their minds. Well, of course, not at all. But what that little three-minute public presentation started was 15 years of fighting to save the structure. We actually got pro bono representation from a law firm, and we won a federal lawsuit with National Environmental Policy Act under those guidelines, and we won the lawsuit, and still the Park Service was able to tear this building down. The Park Service actually is the agency that determines historic significance, and they were unable in this case to see clearly enough past the bias and see that building what it could be. All they saw was just a really old structure that was destroying the integrity of the battlefield.
Now, at some point down the road, you're going to do a book on Mission 66, which tell us about Mission 66. And it sounds like the Park Service, and from what I can see, is trying to run away from Mission 66 as quickly as they can.
They were. There's a little bit of a change back. There always have been advocates for it, but it's always split the Park Service right in half. Mission 66, though, started in 1956. It was a 10-year effort, really, to get all of the parks upgraded by the 50th anniversary in 1966. So as part of that, they built 100 visitor centers across the country. All the visitor centers were modern, which is amazing, right? A collection of 100 federal structures, all modern, all designed by different architects primarily, and all suitable for the specific park that they were in. So each one was different than the other. This wasn't just we're going to build.
Cookie cutter, yeah. No, this was every site was designed for the location.
Everyone, very distinctive.
And but it doesn't fit with the rustic history, right?
It doesn't. So what happened, which was not good, was that they would put a Mission 66 modern visitor center next to their 1930s Civilian Conservation Corps stone building. And people said they were embraced. It was great because they had restrooms and they had everything you needed, interpretation, everything that wouldn't fit in the old building. But after a while, people said, this building doesn't really go with that building. And we prefer the rustic building. And then also the other problem is modern doesn't age as well as a rustic building ages. So if you don't take care of your rustic building, kind of looks, you know, creative and scenic and picturesque with the stone and the, you know,
and the moss growing
and the
on
moss on it. If you do that to your modern building and it has moss growing on it, it doesn't look very good. So as they started to age, the modernism deteriorated pretty badly. They both deteriorated, but the modernism looked worse. And then they just really started to be picked on, really.
Yeah, and there have been several others. I remember going to Dinosaur National Monument, and it had this incredible, you know, glass on one side, this sort of round rotunda, and which was ADA compliant, you know, mm-hmm. because it had this nice general probably the incline was probably too steep, but had an incline, and it had a round ramp to go up to it. Really cool building, and I guess that's gone now, right?
That was gone in part because the Park Service, in part not. So that structure was by Anshin and Allen. It was an amazing, amazing. So you are now a time traveler because you can come back to the future, right, and tell us about that building. It is gone. But what happened is it was built right on the rock where then there were actual fossils exposed where you could see them. It was an incredible structure. But being built right on the rock, well, the rock in Utah kept moving. So this plan was not a longevity plan for this building. The rock kept moving. All those glass panels started to shift. I think you probably could have saved it, but I think it just didn't work out for that one.
Now, I don't know if the Mount Rushmore Visitor Center was a Project 66 or was it? Does it predate that?
No, it was Mission 66, and it's in the Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, North by Northwest. If you've seen North by Northwest where Cary Grant is pretend shot, that was not a set. That was filmed at Mount Rushmore. And I was back to Mount Rushmore since they've replaced that. And I tell you, a lot of the charm of, even though it probably handles crowds better, there's no doubt about it, there is something lost at that site because that building and the beautiful windows, that even though they have new buildings with beautiful windows looking up at the sculpture, there's something different, and there's something horribly lost about that.
I think we're living in a time right now of different scale for the buildings. I feel like all the buildings are designed and then increased by 10%. and growing up in the 60s, I'm used to buildings being a smaller scale. So I'm comfortable with the smaller scale. I don't think that, you know, today the public is comfortable with smaller scale. They like the big scale, the huge mall, right? Mm-hmm. The two-story entry to the building, to the house, to everything.
Even a low ceiling gives people a claustrophobic.
People don't like low ceilings. So anything that has that is really on the list right now for getting replaced.
Yeah. Are you keeping up with what's going on with the Mission 66 buildings today? I know you're kind of got a book in the background of doing a book on Mission 66.
I'm always keeping up with those. So one that it would be good to see if people wanted to see one that has been restored is at the Wright Brothers Memorial in North Carolina. It was Aunt Jurgala designed that building, an architect in concrete, and it was supposed to resemble like early flight. But it's rendered in concrete with glass windows. It's beautiful. It was it was going to be demolished. Instead, it was completely restored and is now functioning as a visitor center there.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with that work and also with the Capon project, which is going to come to a conclusion here soon. Christine Madrid French, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Architectural historian Christine Madrid French speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She'll be a guest of Modern Tulsa, the Tulsa Foundation for Architecture, and Philbrook for their Third Thursday event getting underway tonight at 5:30. She'll be speaking on saving the modern century. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWJS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher.